Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins, and I'm live in person in Hammersmith with Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Murison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
Also with us in persons are Bill Brewster.
Hi there.
And Frank Broughton.
Hello.
Welcome, gentlemen. Bill and Frank are the revered founders of DJ History and the co-authors of Dance Music Bible, Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, which is just being published in its third edition by Lee Braxton's White Rabbit imprint. We're going to talk about that seminal book, obviously, plus we'll hear clips from a wonderful audio interview you guys did with drum and bass DJ Fabio. And on a much sadder note, we cannot avoid talking today about Dom Phillips, the former Mixmag editor for whom both our guests wrote and whose voice indeed is heard in Last Night a DJ Saved My Life. Bill, Frank, let's start with a quote from the book's new intro, which made me chuckle. We wanted the grown-ups with their Beatles books to understand that DJing is clever and complex and very influential. Now, thankfully, we can relax. Bill, would you care to comment on that?
Well, I think when we originally wrote the book, we were on a bit of a mission to kind of establish the DJ beyond the general perception of what they did, which was playing other people's records. What's so clever about playing other people's records, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, as we dug more and more into the past, we realised that they'd had a huge impact on the direction of popular music in all kinds of different ways, the different uses of technology, the different ways in which they pushed music forward. And we kind of wanted to bang a drum about that and about disco, which was a dirty word when we wrote the book still. And now, obviously, all of those things have changed. I think most people accept that the DJ does have a place in kind of popular music history. And equally, nowadays, there are disco festivals every other weekend. So yeah, obviously the idea of disco being slightly laughable has thankfully disappeared. And I hope that our books kind of started the ball rolling and contributed to that kind of feeling.
Frank, did you both have the same sort of missionary zeal when you started talking about doing this book?
Well, the book started, I mean, the gestation was that it was going to be a book about disco. And that was from living in New York, meeting each other and talking about a lot of the people we'd met in clubs who had fabulous stories, you know, older gay guys who'd survived the AIDS crisis, just telling you about the sort of decadence of the 70s and 80s. And obviously the music was important to us. And then the brainwave came when we were back here. Doug Young at Headline, who commissioned the book, said, well, why don't you write the whole history of the DJ? Because no one's really done that before. And that was like a bit between the teeth, really, because we just thought, right, well, we're going to nail it. And so I think we went quite megalomaniac on it. I think we were in a good position because we had a transatlantic perspective. We knew that dance music had started before 1989 and probably before Ibiza.
It's quite a big fact.
And I think, you know, just from writing about dance music, we had a lot of the story in our heads. We kind of knew a lot of the important moments, certainly in where DJs had been influential and changing the craft and influencing music. And I guess that would be hip-hop and it would be disco. And really, they're the dual axles on which the story turns, I guess.
Yeah, you do go considerably further back. I mean, one of the featured people in the first edition, certainly, I don't know if he still is featured in the second edition quite so much, is Jimmy Savile, who was a sort of pioneering DJ in Yorkshire in the 50s. Would that be
Otley?
Otley, yeah. Otley in Leeds. Well, Bill was talking to a lot of the Northern Soul guys, and it was them who really turned us on to his role.
Right.
I mean, we've obviously rewritten that part of the book.
Strange, that.
But he is still in it, and I think his influence is undeniable.
Yeah.
Whatever his motivations were, and obviously in many cases they weren't particularly benign, but we felt like we couldn't erase him from that history.
We have your audio interviews with him here, and we've
just sat there on that show.
And we've sort of slightly questioned whether or not we should post them on the site. Is it, exactly.
It is difficult, and I've had a number of people saying he shouldn't be in it, and I'm like, well,
can't rewrite history.
History is messy, and things that people that you don't necessarily like or don't approve of do amazing things sometimes, and you can't really, you have to kind of square that with what they did and who they are as a person. You have to separate out those things.
And anything involving things like, well, music, popular music, is full of people of all kinds of horrifying sort of...
You can't write them all.
You can't be anything less.
Much less. No.
Well, I think it's important to remember that he wasn't really a music lover, and it was very much the entrepreneurial side. Yeah. So if that makes it easier to live with him, he was very much just chasing the money and chasing the adoration and the fringe benefits as he saw them.
But with two turntables.
That wasn't unusual in radio.
Right,
I mean,
true.
We've got, there's a picture in the book of Christopher Stone, who was the first kind of music playing DJ on the BBC, mm-hmm. and that's from the 30s, and he's got this custom-made double turntable.
Right.
So, you know, it's not an idea that was new. Jimmy Savile's story was that normally there'd be one record player in a cinema. That was kind of where they were installing it, and he said, well, can I have two?
Right.
I mean, you have to take his stories with a little bit of a pinch of salt, because mm-hmm. he was such a relentless self-publicist. Mm-hmm. But what is undeniable is that he moved the UK from dance bands to DJs.
Yeah.
And he was important, and he was recognised by the Mecca dance hall organisation, and he was sent around the country to instigate this. He was sent around to actually bring in this new format, explain how it worked, hire DJs, train them.
Mm-hmm.
And such. So it was kind of an economic shift that he brought about. And, you know, that's very entrepreneurial. But I think music and a love of music was far from his mind.
Bill, how did you get into dance music in the first place? I mean, what was the record of the moment or the club where you became a sort of disciple?
Well, I had a minor flirtation with it in 1976 when I was at an FE college in Grimsby, and two of my friends who were gay took me to a Northern Soul night at Cleethorpes Winter Gardens, which I really enjoyed. But then I saw the Sex Pistols quite soon after at the same venue, and I'm afraid the Sex Pistols won out over take away the pain stain. So, you know, at the time I was 17, and the Sex Pistols kind of spoke to me in a much more immediate way. So I think really my introduction to it came from post-punk. So I was an avid reader of the rock press and was really, you know, bought The Enemy religiously every week. And really it was bands like A Certain Ratio that kind of changed me, I think. I went to see them play three or four times. I went to see them in particular in late 81 playing in Leeds. And we, all the people that we went together to this gig where they were promoting their new album, Sextet, we formed a band the next day, and we were trying to make kind of our version of dance music, which was sort of influenced by Gang of Four, A Certain Ratio, 23 Skidoo, but also bands like Tower of Power and Grand Central Station.
Oh, nice.
So we had a brass section, and yeah, we were doing a kind of a skinny, white, Grimbarian version of dance music.
Is there any recorded evidence of this, Bill?
Yeah, we actually got a record deal. We were signed by Saul Galpin, who later ran Nude and signed Suede. So he was A&Ring for a label called Camera with a K, who had...
Echo and Bunnyman?
No, they had Mark Almond, The Fall, LA, Palace Schoenberg, Brigandage were on that label. There were a few kind of interesting acts on that label. Yeah. And we put out one single, got played by Kid Jensen, got played by John Peel, and someone amazingly uploaded it to YouTube as well. So if you want to hear the full horror of my vocals, then...
Sorry, name of the act?
We were called Group Therapy, and we did a single called Artifact.
That's going into
that's
the episode.
Definitely.
That's definitely going into the episode.
So yeah, that, and from there it just I just listened to indie music much less as the 80s wore on, and listened to a lot more hip hop and electro, and then house, and but also I was like delving into the past in a heavy way in the 80s. So I was buying all of those like Soundstage 7 reissues on Charlie of like Roscoe Robinson and Ella Washington all of those kind of things. So just massively getting into like old black music and new black music. So but I'd say by about 85, 86, I'd completely disowned rock music and wasn't listening to any of it.
Date. We'll never listen to another rock record after.
Well, I remember
or write another Beatles book.
Well, yeah. I went to the Pixies in 1987 at the Brixton Academy, and then I don't think I saw another rock band for about 15 years. So, so yeah, I just really got into recorded music much more than live music. So 12 inches and albums was my kind of obsession.
Makes sense. Frank, what's your story when it comes to dance music?
I'm quite a late developer, I suppose. I was in London in 1989, and I was one of those people that didn't really get house music, and I was still wedded to kind of... it was Rare Groove was the big thing, and I was very much about old soul records, funk and soul, and, of course, hip-hop and things like that. And it was really only when I ended up in New York in the early 90s that I really started enjoying going clubbing. I went to High on Hope, Norman Jay's club, and I went to Manassa. So that was really my sort of London clubbing debuts. But then in New York, I started, went to a few straight clubs and really just thought, this is horrible. I remember going to the Limelight, and it was when techno was just really coming into New York and getting a presence on major dance floors. And I just thought, this is just too testosterone for me. And then ended up going with some friends to see Frankie Knuckles at the Roxy, and that was transformational, really. Wow, just sort of amazing. Seeing Frankie play, and it was a very kind of flamboyant, very there was a runway, let's put it that way. There was a runway on the dance floor. It was one of those kind of nights. And everyone was amazing and beautiful, and then someone actually picked me up and said, do you want to come to the Sound Factory with us? This is after going to the Roxy regularly. And I was like, well, you know, I'm straight. And then that's okay. And I thought, well, I'll go to the Sound Factory then. And so someone paid for me to go to the Sound Factory the first time to see Junior Vasquez, which transformed my life, really, because I think the way that he played music, it was so tribal and so just you would just lose yourself in these endless records that just went on. And it was about the time of sort of Wild Pitch, DJ Pierre kind of sound, that sort of hypnotic house music where very little changes and it's just quite minimal. So, yeah, and then around a couple of years later, Bill turns up in New York and the rest is history.
The rest is DJ history.
Well, you started putting on parties in New York, didn't you? That's where your low-life parties started.
Yeah, I mean, we started putting on parties because the Sound Factory closed and we didn't have anywhere to go on a Saturday night.
I think
the factory closed in Feb 95 and I think we did our first party within, like, 2 months. And we did... like four or five when we were living in New York, and it didn't have a name at the time.
Right.
And then we moved back to the UK end of 86 and started doing them early 87 in the UK. And again, we didn't have a name for them until we'd done about four or five. Yeah. So I think we'd maybe done as many as 10 parties before we actually realised that we were going to keep doing parties and maybe we should give them a name.
I first met Bill when my band played Daytime Live in 1988. And Bill
basically was Pebble Mill at One Pebble with Alan Titchmarsh.
Exactly, with Alan Titchmarsh. And Bill was writing for a football fanzine When Saturday Comes and had just come back from Albania, where he'd been escorted a group of fans to go and watch England play in then Enver Hoxha's communist Albania. And we were on it. And so we hung out for a bit. We almost shared offices and all that. And then there was a big gap. And then my nephew took me to Fabric in 2000, the first pill I'd ever taken and so on and so forth. You know. And we were standing outside at 6 in the morning and, you know, they give out the flyers. And I get this bunch of flyers. And we're looking through them. And there's your name. And I said, oh, I know Bill. My nephew says, oh, he wrote Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, the Bible of dance music. You know, we laughed. A week later, I got an email from you out of the blue saying, I've got your copy of Nelson George's Where Did Our Love Go, and you're not getting it back. And the next thing you knew, you come down to Fabric. We saw you down at Fabric, then it's come to one of our low-life parties, and that was the beginning of a very extended elderly adolescence for me.
That's such a great story.
Have you still got the Nelson George book?
Yeah.
This podcast is
pointedly didn't bring it in, yeah.
Yeah. We've had quite a few guests sort of going public, as it were, on air with like,
debts.
I still owe Simon Frith £200.
I think it was only 70 quid.
It was just 20 quid, probably. Which was worth probably 200.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, well, so you've still got the book.
Yeah.
And I've got to thank you for what says 2000, so now it's 20 years of really great parties that I've been going to as directly as a consequence of you two guys. You know, it's completely corrupted me.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
It's completely corrupted.
He was never the same again. Guys, tell me just a bit about Mixmag, and then we'll talk about Don Phillips. But Mixmag, you both wrote for. When did you first write for it? When were you first aware of it? Who was the first to write for it?
I think I might have been just before you, Frank. Basically, it happened because of When Saturday Comes. So I was working at When Saturday Comes, and Nick Gordon Brown, who at the time was assistant editor at Mixmag, probably about 1990, called the When Saturday Comes office, and Nick was a big football fan. He supported Queen's Park Rangers. And the editor, Dave Seaman, also the DJ, Dave Seaman, is a big Leeds United fan. So they were really into football. And they rang When Saturday Comes to get someone from When Saturday Comes to write bits about football for Mixmag. And we got talking on the phone, and I was going out clubbing regularly. And once he realised that, he started commissioning me to kind of do little bits and bobs for Mixmag. So I carried on freelancing for Mixmag while I was still at When Saturday Comes. And then when I left When Saturday Comes, towards the end of 93, Nick offered me a job working for DMC, the parent company. So I edited they did a weekly trade magazine called Mixmag Update, which went out every Thursday to record stores and DJs, people in the music industry. I edited that for a year, and then I was offered the job of running the DMC office in New York, which is how I met Frank, because Frank was working for Update USA, which was their monthly trade magazine in America. And Frank was one of the writers. So basically, we started working together as soon as I moved to the States.
Okay. Frank, how do you remember Don Phillips?
He was just one of those people that's interested in everybody, a really beautiful, gentle soul. And I think that goes to the heart of his journalism.
We've just got to say at this point, listener, that Don Phillips has died in Brazil, murdered with... I remember the name of his...
Bruno Pereira.
Ghastly, ghastly event. So hence us remembering him now. Yeah. Sorry, Frank, carry on.
Well, I think his character, he was such a positive person and such a gentle person. And I think, you know, thinking about how... I mean, I met him through Mixmag. He commissioned my first feature. So I'd been writing for little things for ID and Mixmag and Hip Hop Connection, but just little reviews and small pieces. And Dom in 91, I think it was, asked me to write about New York techno. So that was when I first met him, and he came over to New York shortly after that. And I remember going to a warehouse party with him in Williamsburg, where there were chickens on the dance floor, and he never forgot that. I think every time he'd remind me about that. There were upside down Christmas trees hanging from the ceiling, and there was chickens on the dance floor. So that was always
you had just taken some particularly extreme chemical.
But I think, I mean, as a person, he was. Just, I think, you know, he wanted to, his title of his book was How to Save the Amazon Rainforest. And I remember him talking to me in such a positive way about how this was possible and how it's all to do with empowering the indigenous people to be the protectors of their own lands and things like this. And he really was on a mission to do it. And I think he's so driven and you know, believing in a better future for the world. And that's the real tragedy. You know, I'm not sure that his book will see the light of day.
Right.
Also, I think, and he was he underplayed what he was doing so much that when he came home and you spoke to him, there was never a sense that there was any danger in what he was doing at all. So this is just been so shocking to realise how much risk he was actually taking. And I think I certainly underestimated it, because the last time he was home, which was about maybe 6 months ago, we all went out for lunch together, didn't we? And he invited me to Salvador, which is where he'd moved to recently with his wife. And
that's in what part? Is that... It's in the Amazon basin, is it, Salvador?
Where Salvador's kind of north of Rio, okay. but a good distance from the Amazon, I think. But I think his wife was from Salvador originally, and I think he just wanted a bit more of a less frenetic life, because he'd been living in both Rio and Sao Paulo, both of which are fairly crazy cities, and sure. I think he was...
They're talking about adopting children as well, and I think her family being there made that sort of... more of a thing, yeah.
I mean, he was just a really great guy, and just, I don't know, how something so violent could happen to somebody like him is just, I don't think I'll ever kind of quite get my head around that.
Right.
No, well, I'm really sorry that you've lost your friend and you know, former colleague and editor. It must be absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, it's heartbreaking just how under threat journalists are worldwide. I mean, and particularly in Latin America, just, you know, Mexico. It's just horrific, isn't it?
I mean, that's the worst thing, isn't it? As soon as you hear of someone going missing in Brazil or Mexico, sure, or somewhere like that, you automatically fear the worst. Yes. And unfortunately, that is what's happened.
But brave, I think we have to say. I mean, there's a clip of him speaking to Bolsonaro and asking him very difficult questions shortly after he was elected, about the rainforest, and it leaves you, when you see it, it leaves you in no doubt that Bolsonaro was made to feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's brave, that's proper journalism.
And he replied to Dom, "The Amazon is ours, not yours." Which, of course, you know, takes us into the much bigger debate about, you know, the Amazon is vital to everyone on the planet. I mean, you know, I mean, unless you are a hardline climate sceptic, you know, it isn't just Bolsonaro or Brazil's. And anyway, I mean, yeah, it's horrific. In Last Night, you talk about the early days of Mix Mag. I think, Frank, you said there was some fairly tasteless stuff, like wet T-shirt kinds. It was very hedonistic.
Well, I think it was a trade mag for DJs originally. Yes. Was very much
mobile DJs, really, more than the club DJs.
You say it's about, a magazine like Music with a Z is very much more wet T-shirt competition. Actually, look at Mix Mag, and actually it's not too bad by the standards of some.
I think everyone is guilty of that objectification, sure, to a certain extent. And when you've got young, pretty young girls dancing, it is, you know, it's inevitable. Unfortunately,
it's part of what attracts a lot of people to dance music. I mean, you know, the interview that we're going to listen to in a bit, you know, he's saying, why did I get into being a DJ? It was a good way to get girls, you know. Yeah. I think, you know, part of it in a way.
I think most of the really good DJs, I think, are essentially music salespeople. Yeah. They, you know, from the age of about 13 or 14, I was making my own little pause button tapes to give to friends and to give to girlfriends. Yeah. And DJing is really just an extension of that. Yeah, it's like, absolutely, look at all this amazing music that I found. Yeah. Yeah. I want you to know about it.
Yes. I mean, and also, the best dance floors aren't like that either. I mean, I think there's a very big difference in some of the more interesting, like your nights and other sort of fairly underground nights like that. I'm going to, let's say, Fabric, where women have to virtually circle the wagons to keep the, you know, keep the men off themselves, off them. But actually go into like a good dance floor, like whether it's Colleen's Loft Parties or your Low Life Parties, and they are really not predatory places at all. It's the opposite. It's all about celebration.
Yeah. I hope that comes through. I mean, we've always tried to kind of have no VIP, no green room, no special area, everyone's the same, and try and sort of treat it as a kind of area of equality for one night.
Yeah, yeah. Got no champagne buckets.
you obviously haven't been to a low life party.
And a big area for chatting. I think that
Yes.
There's always got to be a kitchen at the party. Yes. So I think that's quite a principle of low life.
Is nice.
The only one that wasn't that great was where there was no room to chat.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the worst things when you go out and you're with all your friends and then you can't, there's nowhere to actually catch up and you're just in the really noisy bit for forever and ever and you can't.
Slightly random question. Did you notice a problem when they brought in the smoking ban? Of maintaining a dance floor with a smoking ban.
Yeah, it actually had a really big impact. I remember the weekend that they brought in the smoking ban in Ireland, which came in maybe like about 2 years before the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I did a gig in Limerick, and when you're DJing and you're fairly experienced, you generally have control over the dance floor.
Yeah, yeah.
You can totally control it, and suddenly there was competition. Nicotine was my new enemy. I couldn't, all of a sudden, people in the middle of a record for no reason would all piss off to go and have a fag.
Yeah.
And suddenly you were like, shit, this is a problem. And it took me about 2 years to kind of get my head around that.
Wow. I really noticed it as a punter, really noticed it.
Suddenly
the doors opening, closing all the time.
Yeah, would be a lot of random, uncontrollable departures from the dance floor, which was very difficult to kind of get your head around.
It would throw you.
How did you adapt? Did you adapt? What did you do?
You adapt, and also fewer people smoke.
More cheesy floor fillers.
Wall-to-wall cheesy floor fillers.
Getting honest here. Frank, I was interested to hear you say that originally Last Night was going to be, well, it probably put in a different title, but it was going to be a book about disco, which is a particular like dance floor passion of mine. So I was fascinated, you know, to read the disco chapters way back when and to revisit them. Tell us about the process of, we were chatting before we started recording, the process of doing this book, how much more difficult it was to get interviews, to track people down. I mean, I'm amazed that you managed to do this over the space of 2 years. It's an enormous book.
We had a body of interviews to begin with. I think we've both been interviewing a lot of people who ended up in the story and were quoted even from interviews we'd already done.
Yeah.
But once we'd got the structure down, we realised that, you know, most of the people we needed to speak to were in New York, Chicago, London. And we just set out to interview them. It was as simple as that. Mm. And we sort of divided it up. So, I mean, the classic, we went over for 2 and a bit weeks together, and I was going up to the Bronx every day and interviewing the founding fathers of hip-hop while Bill was down in the village talking to all the disco pioneers. To answer your question about the process was really a backwards relay. It was like, okay, who taught you this? Who was important to you? Who was influential to you? And I think in New York, the hip-hop story had, apart from David Toop's book, no one had written about hip-hop.
Right.
We didn't even know if Kool Herc was still alive. Mm-hmm. People kept mentioning Kool Herc.
We've got on the site your fantastic interview, which isn't where he gives you a tour of the Bronx, you know, showing like where disco world was or whatever. It's just brilliant. And then at the end, it's sort of some discussion about money, possibly.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to my sister, I think, was the line.
That was the sad realization, I think. You know, even someone like Grandmaster Flash, he picked me up in this really rickety old ancient car and we went to his house, which wasn't particularly grand. I think he's doing very well now, I think.
Yeah.
You know, subsequently to being understood, the history is understood a bit more. But back then, you know, he obviously wasn't doing too well. Even Grandmaster Flash, who's the one with the name recognition. So Kool Herc, you know, people didn't know if he was alive or dead.
Right.
And that made the interviews quite interesting because people were really prepared to get into the minutiae and go, well, who was the first person to say hip? And who was the first person to say hot? and there was competition. You know, I interviewed Curtis Blow. I think this is on the site as well, but I interviewed Curtis Blow and Afrika Islam was listening in.
Right.
And they started having this sort of tussle about who was the original B-boy, who was a more genuine B-boy.
Oh, I love that.
So, you know, these people hadn't had their story told, probably didn't expect to have their story told.
Mm.
And, you know, because of that, there's an honesty to it. And you know, especially when you meet someone like Kool Herc and he takes you round the places and actually sort of shows you. And one of them is a mattress factory. It was brilliant. And we would meet up in the evenings and compare notes. And I think, you know, that was when we started realising there's a lot of connections between hip-hop and disco that kind of were being denied.
Brooklyn stuff, the mobile guys in Brooklyn are basically playing disco, but... you know, with someone talking over the records and stuff.
Yeah. Well, they'd taken the mixing techniques of the gay clubs in Manhattan and transported them to Brooklyn, where people like Grandmaster Flash heard, Pete DJ Jones DJ.
Yes, Grandmaster Flash, people like that.
And because we were writing about hip-hop and disco, I think we were able to make those connections much more readily than someone only writing about hip-hop or only writing about disco.
Because you can't take the things in isolation. I mean, for starts, a lot of music's the same music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the same
all the early hip-hop records are really built around disco grooves, aren't they? There's so many of them. So.
Yeah. Mm. I said a hit. Hit me to the hip hop, you don't stop the rocket to the bang
bang boogie, say up jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat. Yeah, so someone like Pete DJ Jones was a revelation, and, and to go to his house and see his gear and him playing Gut Bucket records. I call him Gut Bucket. So, and he was essentially who mentored Flash. So Flash was the brainwave that he had was, okay, Cool Herc was playing the breaks, so he'd be playing lots of little chopped up tiny bits of records, but he never made much effort to mix them on the beat.
Right.
So you'd have a, you know, 30-second great bit of dancing, and then you'd have to reset and ka-chunk. Whereas Flash had seen Pete DJ Jones and Cool Herc and decided to synthesize the two. And, you know, and he'd learned all the tricks of actually beat matching and mixing records together from Pete Jones.
Yeah, so. Fantastic stuff. I actually loved the book. I mean, you know, because this is a story you haven't been told before, you know, really hadn't been told before. And it gives you a sense that there's a sort of massive hinterland of life. And it's not a rock story. It's a very different thing. It's not about bands. It's not about those sorts of individuals. And it's about communities, whether it's a rec room in a housing estate in South Bronx or whatever. And community is, I think, one of the things which runs right through dance music from beginning to end.
Yeah, I don't think it's any coincidence that lots of the clubs kind of... the names of them evoke that community, the shelter, you know, house and all of these different things, the loft, they're all, the sanctuary, all of them are very much about kind of a safe space for people to come together into, and I think that's why it's often a story of black, Latin, gay, marginalised communities coming together to kind of celebrate whatever their differences are, and I think that's been a really important part in the kind of development of dance music.
When we get to Paradise Garage, then terms like the temple and sacred ground come through in your book, don't they? And so Larry Levan is such a central figure in the second disco chapter. You talk about, I think, the age of the DJ producer.
Yeah.
So just for listeners who may not know the story, tell us why Larry Levan was so important and that club was such a sacred ground.
Well, the first reason is that he had a very strong connection and relationship with Frankie Crocker. So also his club was open from 77 through to 87. So it's 10 years. That's quite, in club terms, it's a long time. You know, often clubs don't last more than 2 or 3 years. So it dominated the landscape in New York for 10 years. And Frankie Crocker would often be in the booth with him, hear a record that Larry played, and it would be on the radio the following morning. Mm. So that was an important thing. But also, he was just an unbelievably adventurous DJ. He'd play all kinds of records where you're like, really? but did it with such force of personality that he would win you
Pat
over.
Pat Benatar,
Love is a Battlefield. There was a massive record at the Paradise Garage, and he would do all of these things. Yeah. Sometimes he'd play a movie and everyone would sit down and watch it. He just did a lot of different things that were very brave, and Heartbeat by Tyler Gardner, which is a very, very slow, more like a hip-hop kind of tempo record. At a time when everything was up-tempo, he really plugged that. And I think Danny Crivet in the book mentions him playing it 5 or 6 times in the night.
Clearing the floor.
But by the end of the night, he's turned it into an anthem, that's what he was like. And because he played all night, he had that ability to kind of go back to a record and play it again. He wasn't playing a 2-hour set. He was playing a 12, 13-hour set.
Fantastic.
And I think that makes a huge difference. And I think it's a bit sad, really, that the British idea of having two-hour guest slots has infected America and kind of ruined a lot of those clubs in New York, because that was something that really struck myself and Frank when we were first going out to clubs there, that Junior Vasquez was not a guest, he was the resident, and no one else played there.
Yeah.
And in fact, if they had another night at the Sound Factory, Junior wouldn't even let them play in his DJ booth. They had to play on the stage. As far as he was concerned, that was his house.
That's fantastic.
And you weren't coming in it. You were trespassing. That is
brilliant.
And his DJ booth was amazing. It had, like, at the back of it, it had a three-piece suite.
A toaster oven.
It had a kitchen.
It had a toaster oven.
A toaster oven. I mean, it was literally like an apartment.
That's amazing.
With records in it. Except the window wasn't looking out onto the street. It was looking out onto a big square of 2,000 gay men dancing.
That's fantastic.
I think that, I mean, that's the relationship that these guys had with their dance floor. Yeah. And that's why it was so intimate. And that's why it's so spiritual, because, you know, people would talk about, oh, he's in a bad mood tonight. And you'd think about them. There's the story about people would notice if Larry had changed the colour of a light bulb over the dance floor.
Yeah,
people would notice these things.
Polishing the waste
polishing
paper
the bins. It was intentional. I mean, you know, I'll be on record. I've had the most spiritual moments of my life in the Sound Factory. Those were the most, the closest I came to religion. And I think that's true for a lot of people where nightclubbing becomes important to them. And those guys and that time, sort of early 80s, through the 80s, I guess, that the DJs who were doing that, they just epitomised what a DJ could be. I think that's the reason Larry Levan is so famous, because he just epitomised a DJ who had this incredible relationship with his dance floor.
Yeah, yeah.
He also had the ability to break records. And he also was at that time where it's like, oh, you're the best person to remix records and make them better for the dance floor. So it was the same time, this sort of early to mid-80s, were where DJs started to be remixers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he epitomised that, and the DJ would become the expert in making people dance, because that's what they are.
And, you know, also the man had a musical relationship with the great Arthur Russell, who was a completely different beast altogether, sort of a white gay aesthete and sort of art musician. And the fact that these two guys could make really mad records together, I mean, is all over my face. You know, which is a woman singing fabulously out of tune on it. It's such a great record.
Often they would have records that no one else had for years and years. I've heard so many stories of, like, Larry Levan had this version of Trapped, for example, by Colonel Abrams. Mm-hmm. It's a version that he played that has never come out, and nobody seems to know what it is and who has it.
Wow.
And, I mean, Junior would play, I remember an act called Funky Green Dogs. I mean, he had a track called Fired Up, which ended up being a pop hit over here about 3 years later. But he had that for a year before the Sound Factory closed and about 2 years before it was released.
Amazing.
So there were records like that that you would go there because you knew you'd hear this track or that track, which actually was also a little bit the same as Northern Soul DJs, where they would have an exclusive that no one else knew, or they'd cover it up so no one could work out what it was. Mm. And it gave them kind of extra cachet among dancers.
Yeah.
Well, when I see you, you make me lose all control, like a fire burning deep in my soul, and when I feel you, it feels like I'm in heaven. It goes on forever like a diamond.
Should we jump back over this side of the pond? Because I think you moved back to London in 96.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you were going back and forth and all of that. But how do you remember the sort of difference between, you know, the London scene and the New York scene? What did you find when you moved back here permanently? What was changing with moving into the age of super clubs, what you call super club nonsense, which absolutely struck me. So how do you remember coming back?
Well, I do remember. I mean, it was before I came back permanently, but I remember coming back a few times. Maybe as early as 92, 93, I remember going to some parties here and realising everyone was looking at the DJ.
Yeah.
And I think that was the thing that struck me most, because I'd never seen that. And I think that had kind of started, I guess, post rave, as clubs opened and took that rave energy indoors. I think that adoration of the DJ started happening. You know, it was nothing as it is now, but I think that was the biggest thing that I noticed. The music was very different as well. I think the music in New York was still a little bit, you know, a few BPMs slower and a bit more disco-y, and the house music that you heard, there was a lot more classic house, as we'd call it. So, yeah, I mean, the differences were there. I remember, I mean, being out there, and you'd be able to speak better on this, Bill, but I mean, looking at the charts in the UK and the charts in the US is completely different, weren't they?
Yeah, records that were big for us in New York were often completely unknown. There was a Sheena Easton record, 101, which had a David Morales mix, which was a huge record at the Sound Factory, but it was a completely unknown record in the UK. Written and produced by Prince, remixed by David Morales. It's like a proper house classic in New York. Yeah, the one big difference I would say is that you could go to a straight club in London and it wouldn't be crap. Whereas New York, all of the straight clubs were crap, basically, weren't they? Apart from maybe Giant Step,
that's a little sweeping, but I mean, Giant Step was a real phenomenon, and I wrote about that for ID. But Giant Step was the whole kind of guru jazzmatazz era, where hip hop started sampling a lot of jazz music. And, of course, New York has a lot of amazing jazz musicians. So Maurice Bernstein and Jonathan, can't remember his last name. These two guys, Maurice is now a big gig on impresario, putting on big concerts and things. But they launched this club, Giant Step. They were English and South African, by the way. So they had a different view on the whole kind of New York music. But Giant Step was really, really fun and interesting. And that was bringing hip-hop and jazz together, really, in a club setting. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing that was really exciting, towards the end of our time there, there was a lot of... People realised that you didn't have to have a big club to have two record players, two turntables set up. So there was a lot of energy where there were like lots of little bars happening.
Right.
And I think that was kind of killed by Giuliani, who basically reinforced the laws that prevented that.
Yes.
So the cabaret law, which is about you can't have more than three people moving rhythmically or something. and Giuliani, you know, never a hero to many people in New York, even over 9/11. But he tried to close down as many nightclubs as he could, especially these smaller ones, which is just
bars. Probably because his hair dye would have been down to basically gone into them.
And the other energy I have to say was the techno energy and the younger side of things, which grew into the American rave movement, was a club called NASA, which was again started. There was a lot of English people involved in that.
DJ DB.
Yeah. Where was he working? Profile, wasn't he? Or Smile was his label.
I can't remember, but he's another British DJ that had gone over there and kind of was replicating the kind of hardcore / rave scene in New York. And that was a pretty amazing club for energy, wasn't it?
I mean, you know, not to our taste, but the energy was amazing. And it's actually, there's the film Kids is a sort of recreation of the scene that built around there.
Right.
So there's a few nightclub scenes in that. But that was a really important sort of touchstone for America kind of creating its own sound, I suppose. And you know, they definitely wanted it harder and faster.
Which what turned into ultimately into EDM?
Yeah, I think that's the roots of that. I mean, the rave movement over there was curtailed pretty badly over the ecstasy issue.
Right.
So there was this very grassroots rave movement, and it was supporting, there was quite a few DJs coming over there, but there was also quite a lot of homegrown talent that was playing at these big raves. And that was squashed, I struggle to remember the date, I guess around 94, 95, would it be?
Maybe, yeah.
Something like that. And then it was a sort of marketing masterstroke. Instead of calling them raves, they called them festivals. And suddenly it's great. And how much money do you need investing in this?
Yeah.
And that's...
If you go to Las Vegas now, it's like EDM City. There's just like huge events in all of the casinos. And these guys earning tens of thousands of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands.
To play utterly ghastly music to appalling crowds of, you know, vile people, basically.
Well, it's a corporate victory.
Mark,
it's...
say what you're in.
Yeah, because you never
how you
that.
Really feel, Mark.
So, Frank, in the book, in the new intro to the book, you admit that it's a pretty male story. Last night, a DJ saved my life. But you have made an attempt in this edition to kind of address that and to get more information in about female DJs. So tell us about that.
I mean, the origins of the story, the way we researched it initially, was very much this backwards relay race of who taught you, what was this sort of linear influence, because we wanted to find out who was the first person to mix records, who was the first person to beat match, all those sort of technical things. We had a sort of checklist. Can we find this out? Can we find out who was the first DJ to play a record on the airwaves? You know, all these kind of things. And they were all men. And the story is a very male story, and it remains a very male story. Okay. But what we've been able to do, we mentioned almost all the women who are in the... there's a whole chapter on women DJs, and pretty much most of the names, significant historical names, were in the original text, but we had the chance now to expand on their stories.
Right.
So, and I think that's true of the whole book, is that as you get more, I mean, it's 800 and something pages now, so it's definitely a lot bigger than it was at the beginning. And yeah, I think the more space you have to tell stories, the more you can tell stories away from that main narrative. And so we've told the story of women DJing, and it came at a great time, because I think the dam has finally burst. And in an analogous to the Me Too movement, Clubland has recognised that it has a problem. It's not women DJs who have a problem. It's Clubland has a problem not booking enough of them.
Right.
And I think that has changed. And it's only really in the last four or five years mm-hmm. that's changed. But yeah, it was great to give people their due and to expand on their stories.
I mean, interestingly enough, my experience as a sort of late developing clubber, I felt that often women were the best DJs that I'd seen in many circumstances. And I felt that one of the reasons for that is that, in a sense, that they weren't showing off as much, actually. You know, some male DJs, there's a lot of...
Present company.
Entirely exclusive. But I mean, for example, my favourite DJ in London, I think, is probably Colleen Murphy, DJ Cosmo. I mean, because I've seen her doing exactly what you're talking about, 4 or 5 hour sets sort of thing, you know, her part is where she can... And it's very, very deep and black disco sort of the stuff I really, really love. And I think she's marvellous. And I think that the DJ's job is to watch the dance floor, is to be aware of how the dance floor is developing. And I think women are often better at that than men.
Mm. I think, you know, it's probably the same in every industry, yes, to be honest. But women have often had to be better just to get any kind of parity. Yeah, yeah. And so they know that their mixing skills have to be better than average, mm-hmm, because they're all women and they'll be judged more harshly. What's great at the moment is there's just so many young women DJs coming into dance music,
right,
that have got that confidence in numbers that wasn't there before now. And we've come across several really incredible women DJs that have been trying to help promote and it's actually kind of re-energised Lowlife as well. We started booking 50% women DJs at all of our parties, and even though some of them are completely unknown, they're amazing. So I'm actually really excited about some of the ones that we're working with.
Yeah, it's great.
That's really lovely. Yeah.
I think it might be time to talk about the week's audio interview.
Well,
which is...
it's these two gentlemen here.
Oh, yes, it is.
Funny how that works.
In February 2005, talking to the marvellous Fabio, drum and bass DJ, co-DJ with Groove Rider, met for a long time. And it's, you know, it's all about his entire sort of life as a DJ. And he's really interesting. He's talking about Brixton background, blues parties and sound systems. Now, you know, this is a story I think we've all heard before from other DJs from that background, because that's the life they all had. He's very, very funny about it. Very, very... He describes these things beautifully. He's very interesting about how he liked soul as well as reggae, and that was a line that most people weren't willing to cross in those days. And how he talks... We'll play a clip about Crackers in a minute. He talks about being Crackers, this girl seeing him there, and saying... You know, what are you doing here? And him saying, no, it's not me. You know, you're talking about someone else entirely, you know.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, if you talk to someone like Cleveland Anderson or Jazzy B's, those sort of 80s sound system guys... Yeah, yeah. That was the division, and reggae was your parents' music, your older brother's music.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was about, I mean, the story is about these guys reclaiming the sound system for soul music, and Norman Jay is another great example. But that evolution,
yes,
and that... we've written in the book about it was the sort of the dawn of black Britishness, and it's, yes, like this is the first music we have that we can call our own, and everyone met in the West End instead of in the local church halls, and it's a really exciting moment, and Fabio just sums it up.
Let's have a listen to this clip. There's him talking about Crackers.
Give me you, right, right, right. Give me you, right, right.
What was it that attracted you to it? Because every black kid I've ever interviewed in London always says, Crackers was amazing. Yeah. Norman Jay, Jazzy B, Cleveland Anderson, all of them.
I tell you what was
so great.
I tell you what was so great. It was going into a place and it was mixed. That was another thing. You know, blues parties, you didn't meet any white people in there. Very rarely. You used to meet the odd white guy that used to know kind of the guy, the local guys. But it wasn't, it was 99% black. But this was like 50-50. And that's the first time I'd ever seen that. And it was the first time I saw colour didn't really matter. You know, you could kind of like go out with a white girl and it weren't no big thing. Or, you know, a white guy could go out with a black girl. Or you could hang around with white guys. And it wasn't a problem, it wasn't an issue. You had white DJs, you had black DJs, and it was the first time I just felt this kind of like this social kind of like, you know, this is all good, man, and you know, I can kind of like hang out, and you could do what you wanted there in Crackers. And you know, the DJ never talked and didn't mix, but kind of like said you the tracks, and it was like this seamless kind of mixture of funk and soul, and it was amazing. But at the time, you didn't know, it was just like, you didn't know that maybe 20 odd years time you'd sit down and still be referring to this place at all.
This is fantastic. I mean, Crackers, I'd never heard of Crackers until relatively recently, you know. And it turns out to be, it's lunchtime, wasn't it? It was a lunchtime dance.
Well, there was an evening one, I think on a Sunday, and a lunchtime one on a Friday or a Saturday.
And it's like school kids bunking off school to go dancing down at Crackers.
And then go robbing down Oxford Street. There's another big feature of it. Was like, we've been dancing, now we'll go robbing.
Sounds like a great afternoon.
Hey, it's great. And he talks about starting to collect records, starting to DJ, the emergence of electro hip hop, which is very important to him. Tim Westwood, before Tim Westwood became the cartoon character he sort of subsequently has become. Pirate radio, which has been central to black London music forever, really. I mean, you know, I lived for 15 years on a Crossways estate, which is where grime basically was born from.
Well, much earlier than that was the DBC, which I remember being featured in The Enemy and
that's right,
Time Out, the Dread Broadcasting Corporation. Yeah.
He talks about Paul Oakenfold's House Nights, meeting Groove Rider, and nights like Spectrum and Rage. Let's listen to him talking about Spectrum. This is just too funny.
When you went to Spectrum, did it feel like it was very similar? It was the same part of the same scene, or did it feel completely different? It was a very different thing.
Because of the drugs.
Right.
There weren't no ease at all on the soul thing, African scent. You never got anyone out of their minds there.
No,
that was more a smoking weed thing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Maybe a little bit of coke, but nothing widespread. Spectrum was crazy. Spectrum was like every single person was out of it. And you'd never seen people out of it before. And
did you catch on to what was going on?
About the third time I went there.
Yeah.
It was quite scary, though, because you saw...
Walking
there. It was quite scary, man. It was slightly hellish, and that's why you could tell people... a lot of people turned their back on it, because it was... The music was so loud, and the lights were so intimidating, and it was just... And then it was very Balearic, so it wasn't very soulful. The music wasn't soulful. You've got to remember that as well. The music was this kind of flamenco kind of mixture. So that's why a lot of the urban guys was like, fucking hell. And then Acid, which was like extreme. It, at the time, was like punk.
Yeah.
It was just this white noise. To go, and it was like, what the hell's this? But because of this, because of the background, listening to electro, and we was kind of like kept up with electronic music, we was like, fuck this shit, man. It is so fucking extreme. And Groove's always been really extreme. Groove was into Public Image Limited and stuff like that. So he was like, this is me! You know what I mean? He was like, yeah, man, this is like fucking punk music. You know what I mean?
It's so infectious, isn't it?
Oh, great.
I love the phrase slightly hellish.
Oh, that's marvellous. He goes on, he's very interesting about the sort of the evolution out of techno and through breakbeats and jungle, about how these very, and also the scenes around him, how dangerous jungle club nights could be, and, you know, it's not for faint hearted.
I remember one famous phrase in that interview, he said, "We ghettoed the fuck out of the place."
That's right. it's just marvellous, and the evolution of drum and bass and garage. Well, in fact, he does call it garage, which I was rather pleased, because they all have mocking me for calling it garagist. And actually, he refers
United
to
United Kingdom garage.
Garage.
Her Majesty's garage.
He's very funny about taking the name Fabio, flying to Italy, and the people meeting at the airport not believing it was, he was Fabio, because he wasn't Italian or white. and very interesting again about the big outdoor raves like Sunrise and all of that sort of stuff. And also about how, certainly for most of his experience, was so tightly London-based. And we'll play a clip at the end of the podcast where he talks about going to the wild West Country and Slough, or Slough, as he calls it.
I think he encapsulates a trajectory that's so many people had that trajectory from reggae to soul,
yeah,
with a bit of punk in between, and then into house music and acid house and Balearic. I think he encapsulates that whole trajectory beautifully.
Absolutely. And also, I think that generation produced Stormzy and Tinchy Strider. Without them, there would be no Stormzy. Yeah. There would be no Tinchy Strider. Yeah. They really are the forefathers of the that's the birth of black Britishness for
absolutely
me, is that generation of people where they're not rejecting entirely their heritage, but they're looking for something that's specifically fits in with their urban identity.
I mean, drum bass is really interesting because on the one hand you've got these 160 BPM beats over the top, but you've got a reggae bass line underneath, and that's exactly that there, you know, just in that. That's it. Fantastic stuff. He's so engaging. I mean, he's a lovely bloke, isn't he?
Yeah, he's amazing.
Mark
mentioned
Fabio arriving in Italy, and you were telling us a story about Fabio in Italy before.
Well, I've interviewed him about four times now, and every time I've interviewed him, he always seems to find a new story that he's never told before. I've been talking to him about writing his autobiography for the last few years and trying to persuade him, but I don't think he has the confidence to do it, even though I know he has the ability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a work in progress, really.
But you mentioned this one night, and maybe you can't talk about it in the podcast.
he told me about this, well, about the one time he went to Italy. In fact, that time he went to Italy and he took ecstasy for the one and only time in his life, and basically it was before he started DJing, and he ended up crawling downstairs and on the steps and God knows what else, and yeah, it was a bit of a disaster, but it is a very, very funny story.
As a sort of last question about all of that, I mean, how do you see a kind of veteran, you know, DJ / producer like Fabio, how are they regarded today? I mean, and do young people coming into the scenes today, do they have time for Fabio and so forth?
I think it really depends on the individual DJ. I think there are a lot of DJs from that era that are really only playing sort of memorial events, for want of a better description.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like a back to 88 or a back to 95.
It's a lot of back to, isn't
There's
it?
A lot of that. Yeah. Like, you know, UK garage DJs playing back to 96 parties and acid house DJs playing back to 88.
Yeah,
that kind
yeah.
of thing. They're not like that. They're kind of, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they've just kept forging forward and they're still playing regular drum and bass nights. They did actually do a Rage revival night at Heaven about 6 months ago or a year ago. No, it can't have been a year ago. It was in the pandemic. It's quite recent, which sold out and did really well. But that's generally not what their vibe is. They're much more like, we want to play new music. And I think as long as you're playing new music, you're always going to get a younger audience.
Yeah.
In a way that you won't do for like a back to 88. It's like, you know, 50-year-olds going out and dancing in the same way that Northern Soul is very much an older person's game these days.
How do you think DJing has kind of evolved in the last, say, 20 years? And how did you kind of try and fit that in the new version? And what, you know, the rise of like bedroom DJing, like anyone can just buy like a tractor USB thing, plug it into their laptop and essentially start for like £100, just start mucking about and mixing stuff. And what does that mean to you for where DJing is at in 2022?
I think it's a double-edged sword, really, because I think that democratisation of DJing means that everyone can experience the joy of mixing records together and playing music for your friends and learning the... My daughter learned to beat match in about 30 seconds because there's little red lines.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah. You just have to line up the little red line. And, you know, a lot
or
of the
just press the auto button.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that's one thing is that, you know, it's great that everyone can get in on the act. But I think the other side to it is the economic changes. You know, people used to make a living, a really good living, putting out dance singles. And, you know, you'd have a hit in New York, you'd sell 10,000 copies or something. That was a sort of dance floor hit.
I mean, an average 12-inch release when in the mid-90s would have been between 2,500 and 5,000, and a hit could be anywhere up to 35,000 12-inch singles. So there's now, you're talking in the hundreds. A big record now would sell 1,000, maybe 1,500.
A DJ will go to Fonica and they'll listen to everything, then go and download it at home, basically.
Yeah, well, so. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that do vinyl only releases in order to maintain that kind of culture.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it's. I don't think fundamentally DJing has changed, because it's still the same experience of like someone trying to connect with a dance floor playing music.
Yeah.
That's essentially what it is. The technology that you deliver it with has changed, but I don't think fundamentally what you do as a craftsman or an artist has changed.
I mean, my one sort of thing that, you know, when certainly a lot of DJs we all know moved onto laptops and to computer DJing, and selecting a record from a list of like 9-point Ariel on a screen is very different from flicking through your record bag.
It's very difficult. I mean, I've moved from vinyl to CDs to I use Rekordbox now, and I've got a mini Samsung thing which has got 100 gig on it, and no, 500 gig on it, and so I can carry about 2,000 songs with me at any one time. But you have to really, really know the names of the artists. You have to know the names of the songs, because you're like, what the hell is it called again?
Yeah.
Whereas in the old days, you'd flick through and you're like, oh I know, it's got a red sleeve.
You could
find it almost instantly. You have so many visual cues to work from.
And there's a physicality in that as well, which, you know, is just something lovely about it, about seeing someone rooting through the record bag, finding the record, putting it on, playing it.
Yeah.
Is just a sort of a nicer experience than someone just peering at their
aesthetically. There's no question that it is a better and nicer experience. Looking at a 12-inch sleeve on a shelf is a much nicer physical aesthetic experience.
And you have the gut connections. You know, it's the one with the tree on it will make them go crazy. You know, you have those emotional connections. That
just the bend of a corner of the sleeve can tell you that's the record you want.
But the fact is, I can turn up to a gig anywhere in the world now with this thing in my pocket that can make everyone go mad.
Yeah.
And
you're right.
I don't have to carry 25 kilos of bloody records anymore. Yeah. And I feel like I've done my time in the trenches, and I don't really need to do that anymore.
There's new creativity as well. I think that when I first DJed using Rekordbox on a USB stick, what I realised was you could go, oh, I want to see all my songs in BPM order, so I know all the songs that are roughly I could play next. So suddenly you've got this new way of randomising it, because if you had to go, oh, here's the records I packed for tonight, you might have 10 or something that you'd go, oh. But if you've suddenly got 100 records that you can mix in, you're much more likely to do a left field sort of choice.
Kind of inspires you to do something different, just by the nature.
And on top of that, you can also tag tracks as well. Yeah. So, like, you can just write banger, and then you just search for your list of bangers.
Everyone's going for a smoke, quick!
Banger!
Pull up the banger.
Those things are pretty useful. So there are things that you do have that you couldn't have had in the past. Right.
Yeah, and the stuff that Francois Kevorkian is doing now with the stems, that's worth a look. There's this new AI technology that will pull out the stems from any record.
Right.
So instead of having to have the multi-track before you could do that, you can now do that. It'll suck out the bass line. It will suck out the vocals.
Right.
And he's doing amazing things because he's got all the stems anyways, but he's doing this amazing sort of setup with
He'll do one track and take it apart. He did Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush earlier on in the week after all the stuff about her being on Stranger Things. And he's just completely rewired the track.
How interesting.
There are definitely creative possibilities that have been opened up by all of that. The kinds of mixes you can do, the kinds of speeds you can mix between records, it's like, you know, it's all different.
Yeah. I suppose I have to fight my own battle with my propensity to nostalgia, you know, which applies to all kinds of stuff, all kinds of music. You get reach a certain age and you find yourself looking back far more than you're looking forward, you know. So it's really good to hear that actually these things, which, you know, I would find slightly not sure, are actually liberating for you as DJs in many respects. Fantastically useful.
I think the DJ is a permanent revolutionary. Yes. And I think if you were to have the debate between DJs and musicians, that's the difference. The difference is a DJ isn't tied to their past. They don't have to play their hits. They don't have to play the same style as the last record. They can go completely different. So that freedom, and this was really, I guess, the fundamental theme of the book, we wanted to put this forward, that the DJ has more freedom to create new forms of music than anyone else. Right. Because they can, you know, if you think about rhythm and blues, that was all these weird little local scenes in the US suddenly became fused together by radio. Yeah. So suddenly you can play tracks that no one would have heard in their locality. So I think that idea that the DJ is always looking for the next new noise, they're always looking for the next big hit. Because they don't want to play the same old shit. They don't want to play the same stuff they played last time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's probably when you're talking about the sort of greatest hits DJs or back to 88 DJs, that's what separates the people who've transcended that. I mean, we're talking about Francois using this incredible technology. He was from the first era of the disco DJs. Yes. So he's one of those people who runs all the way through.
He's named in Rapture by Blondie. Oh. he's been around a long time, but he's still pushing forward.
That's great. Mm.
You know, it's been wonderful talking to you guys about Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, which, what is the pub date for the new edition?
July the 8th.
So we're slightly ahead of the curve, which we like.
Yes.
But it's wonderful. I'm looking at the hard copy on the table here, and it's a magnificent.
It's vast!
It's 800 it's huge, pages, and it looks beautiful. And you're in good hands with Lee Braxton. I'm really looking forward to receiving our copy in the mail. So thank you, everyone who's got any interest in this subject and this history, this DJ history, should rush out and buy it in July.
And is it, if you pre-order it on Bandcamp, you get,
if you pre-order it via Heavenly Recordings Bandcamp, you get a free kind of Vinyl Maniacs, which was an 80s fanzine run by Charlie Grappone
with a great interview with Sylvester in it, which
and photographs from Keith Haring's birthday party, which is pretty celebrity studded.
Very cool.
That's wonderful. No easy way to segue, or segue, as Fabio pronounced into Elvis Presley. But we're going to try it, maybe via Chuck D's infamous lyrics on Fight the Power. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant shit to me. Straight up racist, that sucker was. Simple and plain. Motherfuck him and John Wayne. Now, it's important to say that he did then go to Graceland and slightly toned that down and said that Elvis had to come through the streets of Memphis and turn out black crowds before he became famous. It wasn't like he cheated to get there. He was a badass white boy. Elvis had a great respect for black folk at a time when black folks were considered the N-word, and who gave a damn about N-word music. So he slightly revised his feeling. The reason we're talking briefly about Elvis is that Baz Luhrmann's no doubt rather gaudy and kitsch biopic is coming out this week. And so sort of Elvis is back with us. And I just wanted to mention a couple of pieces that we're featuring along with the piece I just quoted from, which is a piece called Elvis and Black Music by David Burke from Vintage Rock in October 2015. But the earlier pieces that we're featuring, one is from Record Mirror in June 1965, and it's just rather wonderful. It's David Griffiths, sort of, it's Record Mirror rather congratulating themselves for being the first publication to print a picture of Elvis Presley in the UK in the week ending January 21st, 1956. So he said, pardon us while we do a little boasting, but it is Record Mirror's birthday and we have got something to celebrate. Anyway, he then quotes from that piece from January 1956. One Dick Tatham, in his purposed prose, Griffiths says, introduced the new star as follows. Here he is, girls. America's new wonder boy in the world of warble. The very latest prodigy in the platinum-plated platter profession. Screamer. Fans, meet Elvis Presley. And then a little further on in that original piece, Elvis was 20 on January 8th. He hails from Memphis, Tennessee in the dear old Southland. He plays rhythm guitar too and likes to be known as the King of Western Bop. Publicity boys say he weighs 160 pounds and is 6 feet in height. And who are we to doubt a tall story? Anyway, that's David Griffiths. And then from December 68... Ivor Davis, who was the Daily Express's Hollywood correspondent, actually gets to talk with Elvis. If I understand the piece correctly, he actually gets backstage with Elvis when he's doing the 68 comeback special. And Elvis says, I'm doing this show because I figured the time was right. I'm getting it done before I'm too old. He says, I like a lot of the new groups, like the Beatles. So this is 68. He's referring to them as a new group. Of course, a lot of the rock and roll today is basically just gospel and rhythm and blues, or springs from that. Performers today have learned to trick things up with choruses and electronic gimmicks, but the beat is still there. It's still what I call rock and roll. And that 68 special was in part, wasn't it? It was Elvis kind of going back beginning.
But I still never forgiven him for pinching Scotty Moore's electric guitar, leaving Scotty Moore to play lead on an acoustic. That bit went on like a little ring surrounded by the crowd. Yeah. Elvis grabs Scotty's electric guitar. And so there's no lead guitar playing on that stuff.
No, that's criminal.
That's criminal.
That is criminal.
Yeah.
Why do we think, I mean, aside from the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody was such a sort of massive hit and so everyone's trying these biopics now, why do we think that Baz Luhrmann chose to do Elvis?
It's such a compelling story, isn't he? He's almost the experimental rock star, isn't he? Before him, there was... I know that teenagers and all that kind of stuff existed before, but Elvis was the first one, wasn't he? And it was almost like a Frankenstein experiment in the laboratory of what would happen if you handed up all the wealth and fame to one particular person, what would happen? Yes. And so it's got that trajectory of poor boy finds fame, goes in the army, rebuilds his career, gets addicted to various kind of painkillers and drugs and stuff like that, and ends, I mean, was he 46, 47 when he died, something like that? I can't remember. No. I do remember. It was like 18th of August, 77 or something when he died, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So he was born in 36, correct?
Right, so he would, I'm not sure how old he was, but he was still pretty young when he died. Yeah, I mean, for me, he was from a previous generation. Yes, so when I was growing up, when I discovered rock and roll, and I grew up in a town that was very passionate about rock and roll still, like all of the Dockers all still had quiffs. My dad had a quiff. But I found like Eddie Cochran and Chuck Berry more compelling than Elvis. I do like Elvis's early stuff, but I just really like the kind of dynamism of Eddie Cochran and Chuck Berry more.
I mean, for a lot of us, he's a gateway drug into black music.
Yeah.
This is great, but hang on a second, this is where it's come from.
David Burke quotes, this is quite a famous quote, I'm sure you'll all have heard, and I can't he said this in 56, Elvis, the coloured folks been singing it and playing it just like I'm doing now for more years than I know. They played it like that in the shanties and in their juke joints, and nobody paid it no mind till I goosed it up. So goosed it up, which is which is brilliant.
I've got to say, his version of Mystery Train pisses all over Junior Parker's original.
It certainly does.
It really does. You know, I mean, I love the Sun stuff still, the Sun recordings.
I really love the Sun stuff.
I think they stand up really well still.
It just sounds just so vital, doesn't it?
And right in your face, you know.
Yeah. Frank, do you have any, like, where do you stand on Elvis Aaron Presley?
I love those later sessions where, I don't know if it's even Quincy Jones, but there's long-legged girls with the short dress on and the rubber neck in, and I guess that was sort of the Vegas...
Early Vegas, wasn't it?
But there's some big band and there's some of the gospel backing singers session. It's a brilliant album.
He always had great players with him as well. Yeah. You know, James Burton, people like that. You know, I mean, really fantastic bands. Again, the early Vegas period. I mean, he produced that really great version of Promised Land, Chuck Berry's Promised Land, around that sort of time. Was making some really, you know, in the ghetto, obviously. He had a sort of... You know, a great second act, musically, a really good second act. It didn't last all that long, but he did have it, you know.
I do remember that I was in Woolworths when I found out that he died. I was very possibly buying punk singles.
Well, I'm thinking, how should I feel about the fact that the King of Rock and Roll is gone?
No Elvis, Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Because he just released Way On Down, hadn't he, when he died, and that became a huge hit, even though it's crap. I don't know if you remember that, it was number one for Christ knows how long.
No, I have no memory of it whatsoever.
It's awful, but it was his new release at the time. Right.
There's another movie, there's a biopic made for TV with Kurt Russell in it, which is actually really good. Yes, I think it's on YouTube, so yeah, dig that out. Elvis though.
Don't go see Baz. Watch the straight to TV.
I actually went to see, when I first moved to London, the Astoria had an Elvis sort of bio thing going on there, and they had three different Elvises depending on which period, and Shakin' Stevens was playing, I think he was playing the young Elvis. This would have been like around not long after he died, and that was really good. I thought, I mean, Shakin' Stevens was amazing in it.
I can connect Jimmy Savile with Elvis in one stroke.
Go on then.
So Dan Davis, who wrote the biography of Savile after all the truth came out, had spent a long time before his death trying to get under the skin of him, trying to put... he was trying to get these stories out. He was one of the people who was tirelessly trying to get sources to agree to put their names to them. But he, when Savile died and still the crimes hadn't been fully revealed, Savile, all his clothes were auctioned off, and Dan Davis bought a Stetson. And I said to him, why'd you buy a Stetson? It's not very Jimmy Savile. And he's like, yeah, well, you know who gave him that Stetson? It was Elvis.
Fantastic. Oh,
Jimmy Savile was... Elvis won Vocalist of the Year for the NME. I forget which year, but Jimmy Savile, ever keen to put himself in the frame, went over to present the award to Elvis personally.
And Elvis, in America, went to the States.
And Elvis presented him with a Stetson.
Fantastic.
That is a tremendous story.
That's Elvis Dunn.
I think that's Elvis Dunn. That's Elvis Dunn. Mark, tell us about some pieces you've added.
Yeah, a week ago, which is still current for everyone, Max Jones interviewing Billie Holiday. She's over in London, spring of 1959, to do a TV show. And she, at that point, she had, because of her various narcotics run-ins with the police, was unable to perform in New York because of the cabaret card she couldn't have. Mm. She says, I can't get my police card to work New York, so how can I make it there? America won't let me work. I'm Billie Holiday. Singing's the only thing I know how to do, and they won't let me do it. Do they expect me to go back to scrubbing steps the way I started out? It's good stuff.
And this is only, like, 6 months before she died.
Absolutely. She also says, I always try to sing like a tenor saxophone or some horn. That big vibrato fits a few voices, but those that have it usually have too much. New York Times, 1965, Robert Charlton talking to Bob Dylan on the phone, and Bob Dylan says, it's all music, no more, no less. This is around the time when it's folk rock. He'd just plugged in, was about to play the Forest Hills...
Which was the second really kind of infamous gig, wasn't
it? Yeah, that's right. He says, it's all music, no more, no less. I know in my own mind what I'm doing. If anyone has imagination, he'll know what I'm doing. If they can't understand my songs, they're missing something. If they can't understand green clocks, wet chairs, purple lamps, or hostile statues, they're missing something too.
Hostile statues.
Philip Elwood, 1968, San Francisco Examiner, sees James Brown at the Oakland Auditorium. Philip Elwood's great. He's a jazz writer, but really, really got stuff. For example, we recently posted his review of Sylvester's famous Opera House show in San Francisco, right, which became the live album. And he just loved it. You know, this is a stodgy old white jazz player, jazz fan, you know, loves Sylvester. Yeah, yeah. So he says, the strikingly attractive entertainer James Brown, frantic at times and soulfully somber at others, totally dominated the show, wiped out his audience last night at the Oakland Auditorium. The Georgia-born Brown is the music world's soul brother number one. He earned the title the hard way and proves it every minute he's on stage.
Great.
So, lastly from last week is Bob Marley and Wailers, supported by Gloria Jones and Gonzalez at Hammersmith Odeon, London 1976, reviewed by Giovanni Di Domo and Sounds. And he says, which brings us to my problem. You see, I just last night seen BMW, Bob Marley Wailers, again, and although I confess I had me a real fine time, a lot of time I know one thing, I was not exalted. And I went to that show, and I wasn't exalted either. We'd all heard the live album recorded the previous year at the Lyceum, which is an astonishing record. And I think we were all hoping for that.
The same.
And it wasn't. You know, it was a curious... I mean, it was good. It wasn't bad. But it's just something was kind of missing from there. Bill Haley to Tony Brown is someone we're hoping to find. He wrote for Melody Maker in the 50s. And this is Bill Haley's very first trip to England. It's a report of him getting off the boat at Southampton and getting onto a train and being mobbed by fans.
As he did in those days.
And Bill says, I was worried when they started beating out a rock and roll rhythm on the top of the car. There's a time and place for that. for that beat, but it wasn't here. Pete Johnson, LA Times, 7th May 68, reviewing what he calls Buffalo Springfield's last gig. Buffalo Springfield gave a concert Sunday at Long Beach Arena, sharing the bill with Country Joe and the Fish, Can't Eat, The Hook and Smokestack Lightning. This is it, announced Springfield member Steve Stills as the group prepared to play, confirming rumours that the quintet would split up this week. Gosh. So that may or may not be. Oh, yeah, here we go. Caroline Boucher interviewing Brian Ferry for Disc Music Echo 72. The trouble with the art of being a musician is that, unlike being a painter, you have to be successful. You can't put out your experimental efforts. Dave McCulloch reviewing ABBA in Sounds of 79.
ABBA.
The very stuff which your new music prima donnas will be declaring genius in 10 years' time, assuring us that this is the proletariat's model for 79. Basically, he loved it. He is a post-punk, real post-punk
Which
writer.
Which venue was that?
No, I remember him very well.
Was that the Albert Hall?
I think it may have been the Albert Hall.
I saw one of the shows at the Albert
Hall. Mark, you went to
see
I went to see the...
How are the avatars? I've heard it's really good. I bumped into a friend in the park yesterday and he went and he thought it was good.
I got bored.
Oh, really?
First of all, it's really impressive. You know, the spectacle is just fantastic. The lights are amazing and all of that sort of stuff. These kind of computer renderings of the band are curiously soulless, like they're sort of dead behind the eyes,
right,
in a strange sort of way. And also, even though they're making expressions like smiling, it feels like a computer-generated smile. There's something missing there. Audience were going mad. I mean, I was the only person. I was sat back, my arms folded. You know.
As usual. This may come as a tremendous shock.
Mark Curmudgeon Springle.
Who's that man at the back with his arms folded? Oh, it's Mark Pringle.
I mean, it was really impressive. And of course, the music's great, because, I mean, the music mostly, it really is great. There's a couple of terrible tunes, but they
did. Does it sound live-ish?
They have a live band.
There's a live band playing. Right, okay. Yeah,
so is Little Boots playing keyboards still? Because she was...
I don't know. They weren't introduced. I don't know.
Okay, so I'm quite friendly with her. And and she mentioned on her Instagram that she'd been selected to play keyboards.
Well,
may
well have been. They were in a sort of dark patch, sort of just to one side of the stage. There was one number where they're sort of heavy featured. Between various sections, there would be a bit where a song would be a sort of manga cartoon showing whilst they went and, in inverted commas, changed their stage clothes. And that didn't make any sense to me at all. So things like that. But on the tube train, I went with my friend Tom Fenner from Micro Disney, because he works at BBC, which is why I managed to get a ticket to this thing. We were on the tube going back afterwards, and he starts talking to, because it's full of fans on the tube. And there's this guy next to us who said, "Oh, yeah, I saw him in 1979. This was much better."
Really?
Yes. Wow. Anyway, it was an experience. I'm glad I went, but I had my reservations. I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball. Money, money, money.
Must be funny in the rich man's world. Jasper, you got any treats for us?
I'll mention two things. The first of which is a review of Kanye West's The Life of Pablo by Simon Reynolds in The Wire. And it's fabulously Simon Reynolds, fabulously Wire, but also a really, really great review of a slightly strange album. This is Kanye's seventh album. And Simon Reynolds writes, "The Life of Pablo resists being disentangled from the vortex of discourse. Gossip, leaks, forensic analysis, public meltdowns that imbricates its every texture and lyric. Tempting as it is to hack exasperatedly away at the thicket of context and subtext, from the month-long cavalcade of Kanye in the news to the way that virtually every sound and line seems hyperlinked, in order to get through to the work, capital W, itself, the truth is that the surrounding swirl is the work, or at least an outer but undetachable layer to it." And it's just great. He goes, it's a long, long, long review.
Simon Reynolds.
He's very kind of straightforward and honest about it. As you'd expect, then, Pablo is bitty. It's an album of good bits and shit bits, all jumbled together. Then he can kind of conclude on a note of, every good bit is marred by its proximity to a shit bit. 9 times out of 10, the latter involves a gross sentiment or a mewling, sloppy delivery emitted from the brain and mouth of West himself. Equal parts scattershot genius and splatter shit grotesquerie, The Life of Pablo is a reminder of rap's enduring paradox. Here's an entertainment form based on personalities that in real life you'd avoid like the plague. Monologists, braggarts, slimeball lechers, pullers of rank. You wouldn't want to be with these people. You wouldn't want to be these people. To circle back to the start, that then raises the question, why do we need rock stars?
That is really fantastic.
A brilliant review.
It's a really good summation of Kanye West, especially, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
The shit bits and good bits kind of really sums him up perfectly. Yeah,
exactly. Then lastly, I want to mention On the Rise, Arlo Parks, Pip Williams in the line of Best Fit. And Pip actually goes to speak to Arlo Parks really early on. She's only released one single and only 18 and is now, Collapsed in Sunbeams was Mercury Prize winning, great, really great album from a young singer-songwriter who's went to school just down the road from here at Latimer Upper School.
Oh! There's girls who sit with the tennis rackets going off to...
But you can't afford to be a female pop star now unless you've been to Latimer Upper School.
there's a lot of it about.
Even at 18, she's very thoughtful, very interesting, very self-aware. And Pitt writes, "Parks sits at the forefront of Generation Z, the digital natives born into the uneasy wreckage of this new millennium. Unlike their burnt-out millennial forebears, Gen Z are fiercely individual, dreamers, optimists, creators. All this in spite of global uncertainty and chaos they're faced with every day." Is this contrast that Parks encapsulates in the upcoming single? And Parks says, "In my age group, there's a lot of prevalence of mental health problems, being self-destructive and quite hopeless. I'm not sure if it's social media or what it is, but we're all fucking sad." And she's openly bisexual, and she wants to point that out, but also wants, she says, "Coming out as bisexual was freeing in a way because it allowed me to talk about experience and feelings I didn't feel able to before. Obviously, there's still judgment and it's still taboo, but I didn't want to pigeon myself as the bisexual artist. That's just a part of who I am. That's it. And I think it's great because she's a young woman of colour who's out and queer, and I think it's important. And her music's also just really good, so I wanted to excellent. Mention her. So one to watch, Arlo Parks.
Okay, fabulous. Thanks, Jasper.
I think we're done.
I think we're done, sir. Yeah. Yes.
Well, last clip is Slough.
Slough. She's just calling it Slough. Yes.
From Fabio, which we'll listen to. But great to see you guys. Great to have you guys.
Thanks so much for coming in and talking about your tremendous
fantastic book.
Last Night DJ Saved My Life.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you.
It's been a huge pleasure.
Great. Right, let's on that note.
Bye.
Toodle pit.
Bye.
So did you do any travelling? Because there's like Greg Wilson doing similar things up in Wigan and Liverpool.
No, we never. We was a lot more kind of a... Travelling wasn't really a thing for us. We was kind of like, we've got our kind of localised scene here. And well, to be honest with you, we kind of turned our noses up at Northern Soul. We weren't really feeling the Northern Soul. It was too fast. It was too weird. People, it was Wigan. And it was like, fucking hell. Do you know what I mean? It was like, Wigan, to me, could have been fucking Timbuktu. We just didn't have a... You know, you've got to remember as well, we're living in the age of travel now. Travel was totally different back in the day. You know, there's no way... The thought of even going to Luton, to Slough... To Slough, we used to get ready for 2 weeks to go there. It was like a big fucking thing. We used to be driving... God, this place is fucking miles away, isn't it? Fucking Slough, God almighty. So it wasn't that travelling thing. I know there were guys that did used to do it, but we weren't. It was like fucking Slough was the end of the world for us, man. Do you know what I mean? There was nothing beyond Slough, or Slough as they used to call it.
That was Fabio in conversation with this week's special guests Bill Brewster and Frank Broughton, concluding this episode of the Rocks Back Pages podcast. The new edition of Last Night a DJ Saved My Life is published by White Rabbit and available from July 8th. The host are Bonnie Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Muris and Bowie. The Rocks Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
Last night a DJ saved my life. Last night a DJ saved my life from a broken heart. Last night a DJ saved my life. Last night a DJ saved my life with a song.
Hey guys, this is Kenan Thompson. I have a problem with you. Yes, you. None of y'all told me that Auto Trader has millions of new and used cars that I can shop from home. I thought we were friends. I put smiles on your face, but I'm not smiling. No one told me that with Auto Trader, a dealer can deliver cars to my home or that I could shop by price on Auto Trader. No one. Consider this friendship that you just learned we had officially over. Finally, it's easy. Auto Trader.
Unlock big savings during the Menards Bag Sale. Add style and security with Schlage lock sets. Menards carries over 50 styles of interior and exterior lock sets. And with Schlage's wide selection of smart locks and keyless entry locks, there's no more hiding keys under the doormat or losing track of copies. Save big money on Schlage lock sets. Plus, save 15% when you fit it in the bag. Now through January 14th, available in-store only at Menards.
Save big.